Welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, your headquarters for building a six-figure plus e-commerce business. I'm your host, e-commerce entrepreneur, and Jeff Bezos wannabe, Andrew Derry. Hey guys, it's Andrew here, and welcome to another episode of the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. Today, I've got Bill D'Alessandro, who, if you'll remember, was back on the show in January when both of us were getting ready to hire for our business. And here we are in July. Both of us have successfully hired. Both of us made a bunch of mistakes along the way, and we're going to be talking about how that process unfolded, how it went, and some of the lessons that we learned. So stick around for that. Quick update on E-Commerce Fuel Live in August, which is the in-person meetup for Form members. Kind of some exciting news. We've got a few spots left for that, and I wanted to make those available to E-Commerce Fuel readers and listeners in general. Still primarily going to be a Form meetup for Form members to connect with each other, but wanted to make it available for maybe people outside the Form that are store owners or e-commerce professionals to come on down to the event as long as we have those spots available. And just did a blog post today in terms of really detailing it, talking through the specifics, and also letting you know how you can sign up for that event. I am asking that, or am requiring that all attendees are either a store owner or a professional in the e-commerce space, or maybe a shopping cart developer, a PPC specialist, maybe you're great at email marketing, or you're a designer that have worked on a lot of carts, some kind of professional capacity, not to be stodgy and elitist. That's not my goal, but really to make sure that it's a great networking event for all the participants that come down. And so if you're one of those two, if you're interested in really connecting with some in-the-trenches people, hearing some fantastic talks, enjoying some really focused, intimate breakout sessions, as well as having a really fun opening night party at BigCommerce headquarters in Austin, head on over to ecommercefuel.com. Those tickets are a first-come, first-served basis for the remaining slots. You can find out the details there. Let's go ahead and get into today's discussion on hiring with Bill D'Alessandro. And once again, I've got Bill D'Alessandro with me. Bill, how you doing, buddy?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And I was starting to ask you how things were before we actually went on the record, but then I realized a lot of times you end up having these conversations twice to right. Catch up. What's up? What's been up with you? We're going to get into hiring in a minute, but keep seeing in my Facebook feed like you're on the beach and having a good time in the sun. What have you been up to?
Yeah, I'm coming to you now from the coast of South Carolina. I'm down here at Fripp Island, which is kind of the southernmost point of South Carolina, with four other CEO friends of mine. We're doing a two-week beach business retreat.
Is that actually a beach business retreat, or is that just an excuse to have a vacation and have it be tax
deductible? Well, you know, it's a bit of both. But so, yeah, it's four other friends of mine, all that have internet businesses, some for our Workweek-centric, some digital advertising, all sorts of things. And we all said, let's take 2 weeks and come down here to the beach and really focus and get away from the distractions. And we've been, you know, having discussions every night. We work during the day, you know, head out on the beach. It's actually, there's some real work getting done, surprisingly. It's been great.
That sounds fantastic. And is this spouses, girlfriends as well, or is it just a guy's business only trip?
Just the guy's business only trip, actually. Okay. It's been fun.
Wow. So some romantic, bromantic walks on the beach.
Yeah. I said we got to get away from the distractions. So the girls didn't get to come.
Nice, man. Very cool. Very cool. How's stuff been with Nurture My Body? That's the site, of course, that you took over recently, bought and have been turning around, and you've been doing the big rebrand with it. How's that been going?
Yeah, the rebrand has been live for about 6 months now, and we've been growing about 10% month over month for the last 6 months.
Wow.
And it seems to be continuing. So yeah, it's going really well. We just launched probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago. This has been in works for a while, but I rejiggered all my shipping contracts, and now I'm able to do $3.99 flat shipping for every order under $97, and then free shipping over $97. And that took our conversion rate from high twos to mid threes.
Wow.
Which was a pretty nice lift.
That's impressive. I've been doing some testing on free shipping as well, and I actually, because I had a really old school model, we hadn't really thought about our shipping for a while. And so we were still charging like smaller items, you know, maybe $5-6, but on a lot of items, it was $12, even $18. Cause like, you know, shipping long antennas is not,
yeah,
it can be a little funky. And so we tried a bunch of stuff. We tried, I did a big case study on this in the private forum, but we tried doing the free shipping for just orders over $75. That was slow to artificially try to get people to self-select to pay for it.
regular 1 to 5 day shipping, and then expedited shipping. And I mean, we did see a little bit of a boost on the expedited shipping in terms of conversion rates, but not nearly what I thought it would be. I don't know if we're not highlighting it well enough, or we're just not making it people notice it, you know, how quickly they get it. But I was really surprised by how little. We also, though, I should say, we also bumped up the prices to help pay for that. I don't know. Did you do that?
No, I didn't. So, as I mentioned, I had to rejigger my shipping contract. So I had to go back to FedEx and UPS and my fulfillment center and push them hard and say, we got to get different pricing tiers here because this is what I want to offer. And now, so the whole focus of it is, you know, on the small orders, you know, if it's like one jar of cream, I ship it for, you know, $2.80 and I make about a buck. And if it's, you know, 5 jars of cream, it ships for $6 and I lose a couple bucks. But in the wash, it comes out nearly break even. And my goal with it was really to just increase my conversion rate. Because I had the same problem you had. Like if you ordered like $70, $80, you were getting stuck with $12 shipping bills.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. It gets really complicated trying to think about, okay, well, I'm going to offer free shipping. Because really what we tried to do on ours is we were trying to maximize for profit per day, right? Because obviously free shipping, you offer it for free, you're going to drive up your conversion rate, but you're going to lose more on your margin. And so that was the metric we were trying to optimize for. But there's a lot of moving parts in that. You've got your cost, your margins, but you also have, like, we saw cart when we started offering free 3-day shipping, we saw our cart abandonment drop significantly by like 20%. Yep. So you can't, there's a lot of moving parts in there, and it's not a real straightforward thing when you start playing with those.
Yeah, and the other thing too is if you have a competent fulfillment center that can rate shop across different carriers, and that's what we do now. So we used to show people live real-time quotes like from FedEx and UPS and mm-hmm. Postal Service, and they could pick. But so we've transitioned from offering specific shipping products to speed-based. So now your options you check out are economy shipping 5 to 7 days, which typically is SmartPost or SurePost, the FedEx and UPS products where they take it to the post office and the post office takes it to your door, which is pretty cheap. So you can get that for economy shipping, but that I don't expose that to them. They just know they're getting economy shipping. Standard shipping 3 to 5 days, or expedited 2-day, which is 2-day shipping. So, and then we rate shop the carriers behind the scenes depending on weight and destination address and all of that, which really helps because you get the best rate per package.
Yeah. One thing we're doing too is we have warehouses on the West Coast and the East Coast. And which is nice. And a lot of product crossover between those two. And so occasionally we'll have to, if we end up doing a 3-day, you know, offering that 3-day, I'll have to end up doing the legitimate 3-day. But I'd say the majority of them were able to offer that express delivery time just based purely on location routing from where it ships from, which is, you know, it's nice to do because 3-day and especially 2-day adds up. You ship 102-inch antenna, whip antenna, 2-day air. Woo!
Oh man, yeah.
Spendy yeah. stuff.
Yeah, and then you can get priority mail, I found, is great. If you're within, recently they rejiggered it, so now you know they guarantee it for 1, 2, or 3 day when you ship it. So you know, like priority mail, if it's one state over, it's going to get there in a day or two.
Oh, they actually have, because for a while it was kind of like, hey, maybe it'll probably get there in like 2 to 3 days, but we can't guarantee it. But they've actually gotten more firm about that?
Yeah, about 6 months ago, they changed it. So you have it like a zone map now for priority mail, that it's like it'll be 2-day priority mail or 1-day priority mail or 3-day priority mail. It's like a specific product that they offer now.
That's very cool. I did not know that.
Yeah, awesome. Mix that in. It'll save you a bunch of money.
Nice. Well, cool. Well, let's dive into hiring. And just to remind folks, we did a hiring discussion back in, I think it was back in January of this year. And we'll link up to that in the show notes, because I was bringing somebody on, you were bringing somebody on, and we were kind of talking through how we were approaching that, how we were really thinking through that process. And here we are in June, and unless something catastrophic has happened since I talked to you a couple of weeks ago, you've got someone on board, I have someone on board. And instead of just kind of going through and telling the stories, both of ours from beginning to end, I thought it would be just kind of interesting to go through some lessons that we both learned through the process and kind of let the stories come out of those.
Sure.
So first thing I learned was, man, I don't know about you, but it takes way more time to hire than you think.
Yes, it does.
My process, I don't know about you, but I think I got started in February and then did an initial round in March and then through April. And then for a number of reasons, my two final candidates just did not work out. And I had to start the process brand new from scratch in April and didn't end up extending an offer to someone through May. And I think she came on June 1st. And so, I mean, it took the it took a good five months from when I was thinking about it to get someone on board, and I was not expecting it to take that long.
Yeah, I think mine took about that long too. I started looking in earnest kind of first week in January, and it took me until early March to get someone to start, and then same kind of thing. They did not work out, and I learned some lessons from that, so I had to start it all over, and I didn't get anyone on board full time until mid-May or early May, I think.
Maybe it's hard to do this, but you think about how many hours goes into just getting someone into that first day of the job. I mean, it was in terms of my time and resources, you're looking like easily for like thousands and thousands of dollars. It takes a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. And also it takes you away from, especially when it's employee number one or two, or, you know, the CEO, you are training them. It takes you away from running the business. And there's this unmeasurable impact on the rest of the business piling up as you have to focus full time on training them for the first week or so, or even the first month at, you know, onesie twosie as days go by.
Yeah. And I'm looking at, you know, I've got, that's not something I jotted down, but I think that's another great point, is it just like day one is just the beginning. Like I remember my first, and this isn't a reflection on a candidate or Laura, who's actually the person who came on as the community and content management case. But I remember my first job, we were both banking out of school. I was worthless for the first probably 3 to 6 yeah. months in my job. And it's, I was trying to learn as much as I could, but just, there's a learning curve for anything. And so.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Did you feel that way? Did you feel worthless coming into your finance role, or did you?
Definitely. I mean, investment banking is the deep end. I had done an investment banking internship beforehand, so I knew a bit of what was going on. So I felt most worthless, in months two through four, after the internship had run out and I was climbing the learning curve and had no idea how to do anything but be a number crunching machine. And I, you ask all kinds of stupid questions, and I'm sure that it was nice of the senior people to grin and bear it, because they knew I was going to, take work off their plate eventually.
Yeah. It's really funny. I learned a lot looking back. I remember my first 6 months on the job. I remember going into the associate who was above me, going into his office and asking his questions, and looking back, I was the kind of guy who was like, well, this doesn't make sense. And so I was probably in there every 45 minutes, and I think I drove the guy bat crazy.
Right. It's good. You got to help your employees, because in the long run, that's how they learn.
And number two is, you may be tempted to settle, but don't. Man, I'm just gonna be interested to see if you can relate to this. Like, I had those final two candidates. One, for the reasons we'll get into in some of these other lessons, neither of them worked, but man, I was just like, oh, I so want to just pick one and kind of force the square, block into the round hole, because I don't want to go through this process again. But thank goodness I didn't, because I got someone who fit perfectly. But there's a tremendous, tremendous pressure and temptation to just pick someone, even if you don't think they're the best.
Yes, I felt that also when my first person didn't work out, and I was like, man, I need help so badly. But the thing, and I forget, where I read it, but, it basically said the first two employees define your entire culture. Mm-hmm. And so whoever, it's kind of like a parent, whoever you hire as your first employee, the second employee is going to watch them and is going to be like them. So I think the first one has to be the best one. The one that you want to work with every day, not only because it's just the two of you, but because they're going to influence every single other person you bring on.
Yeah, 100% agree. It ties into number three, which is a culture match is so important. Like, obviously, you're looking for someone who is competent, has experience, that is going to do the job well. But my two final candidates, one of the candidates was... She was a great writer. She was very well qualified, and I hope she doesn't listen to this, because she's a great person, and this isn't anything against her personally, but I didn't relate to her very well. The conversations we had slightly different styles, and sometimes you get off the phone and you're just like, that was great, that was a solid conversation, and then other times you have a conversation with someone and you're just like, oh, I didn't gel, I didn't fit. So I didn't feel like I connect with her personally. And then the other candidate was someone who, she was very competent, but she was in, lived in New York City, one of the most expensive places, in the US, if not the world. Secondly, she'd been in publishing industry for 20 plus years and was, she was making good six-figure income. And she was willing to take a small cut to come on board, but she was grossly, her expectations for the role, she was worth maybe in the ballpark of what she wanted, but she was taking those expectations and applying them to a role where she didn't have any expertise and wanting the same thing. And also, so it wasn't a good cultural fit. And then finally, Laura, who I ended up hiring, like just in terms of she had the expertise and the experience, but also like she had kind of a funny tongue-in-cheek style to her writing, which is something I like at eCommerce Fuel. She could connect really well with people in emails, which is really important. Just she was upbeat and personal, and her expectations were in line for the role. So much culture there that was so important for finding a good fit that I didn't really think it was going to be that big of a deal, but it was.
Yeah, and the funny thing about that is that I catch myself doing this. I think when you so badly want to hire someone or have anything, you know, if you so badly want this business deal to get done or so badly want any objective, you lie to yourself.
Yes.
You know, and you're like, oh, like, you know, you interview this person and your gut is going, this person is not a fit, or this deal is not a good one, or whatever. And then your part of you that wants it to happen so bad goes, it'll be okay, cross your fingers, it'll work out. Or la, 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 don't listen to your gut, because you just want it to work out. And you're like, oh, my gut is wrong. But I have found that your gut is very rarely wrong. And you can't lie to yourself.
This year, after reading like the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, there's like all these rules to work by and things I put together in like a personal constitution, more or less. And one of them on there is trust your gut. And I 100% agree, because I think it's so easy to, I'm just pretty much rephrasing what you said, but yes, 100% agree on the gut aspect. What was it for you on the culture side that was the biggest difference that you saw in the person who didn't work out versus who did?
It was a combination of culture and the other thing you mentioned, which was expectations. And I should have seen it earlier, and I will see this next time I hire someone. But the first person I hired, she had come, I said, hey, I want to hire someone from one of my competitors. So I was hiring for background. I was hiring for a sales position, for account executive position. And I said, I want someone that knows how to sell organic and natural skincare. I want to hire someone who's been there before, that has relationships, and just basically can take everything they've done at my competitor and plug it in right here. And so that was my primary objective. And I did. I hired someone. And it was immediately apparent that she came from a big corporation. She did not have the mentality that was needed to be employee number one. She needed more structure. She needed a very defined role, which was another lesson that I learned and we can get into later. She needed a very defined role, and the role that I was asking her to do was not very well defined. And she needed more support. She was not okay coming into an office and having it be just her and me and being accountable working from home if she needed to. And I think that was a big reason why it didn't work out, because she came from a large corporation and I thrust her into this 2-person startup environment. And she was not, she said she was ready for it. And people think they are, but she was not. And it's nothing really against her. I don't think she was lying to me on purpose. I think she probably thought she was ready for it. And it's a big shift. Whereas the person that I employ now is fantastic. Before she came to me, she had been an independent rep for 10 years. So she had been representing other lines, candles, skincare, handbags, all sorts of other things in stores like Whole Foods, all the places that I am expanding into. So she was basically her own little business. And I don't know, for those listening that don't know how independent reps work, let's say you're repping for a skincare line, you go into Whole Foods, you go in, you straighten the shelves, you meet with the buyer there, you say, hey, is anything out of stock? How about you pick this new seasonal SKU up that we have? You just check on them, you manage the relationship, and then you get a percentage of sales through that store because you're managing that store sales. And you're also responsible for all of your own expenses. So if you say, hey, we want to do an in-store demo, that comes out of your percentage oftentimes. So you're really running your own little sales business, and it's very entrepreneurial. And then before that, she had had a retail store. She had owned a retail store on Cape Cod. And she showed up on day one, and it was just obvious she instantly got what it was like to be an entrepreneur and what it was like to do whatever needs to be done, to save money when possible. She was totally comfortable working in a coffee shop. The stuff I would say, do this and email back to me. She'd work from home. She still works from home with extreme efficiency and she's fine over email. It's just a 180 degree difference in what it's like to work in a big corporation and what it's like to work in a startup. And I think if no one has ever done that startup thing, it can be jarring.
Yeah. And that's a tough thing to gauge from somebody. You can look at their history, right? And I think it's interesting you say that. I don't think that was something I explicitly put my finger on, but thinking through Laura, and she's actually, I mean, she's working out really well and fantastic at, in terms of being efficient and thinking through that, because she comes from, like, she came from L.L. Bean, which is a fairly big company, but she also has a very extensive history of freelance writing, like hustling and getting stuff done on your own, right?
Right.
Independently. And I think that that plays into that really well. Is there a way to gauge that if somebody's thinking about hiring somebody and looking for that super important attribute, apart from looking at their work history? Is there any way to gauge that?
I think it's hard. I think, and I don't know if you met Laura. Did you meet Laura in person before you hired her?
Via Skype, but not in person.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think in person is so critically important. If at all you can do it, I think you can just gauge someone, and particularly if you're trying to gauge if they have that X factor, that entrepreneurial resiliency. For me, I don't know, maybe I just can't read it in a resume, but I really need to sit across the table from someone.
Yeah, you learn a lot from, you learn a ton from people sitting across the table. One thing I'm going to throw in here, wasn't originally included either, is be careful how many people you interview. In the first round that I went through, I interviewed like 12 people. I scheduled like 12 45-minute interviews in the course of like 2 or 3 days. And by the time it was done, I was just, oh, you know, that's just so many people to keep track of.
Oh,
and,
man.
And usually, a lot of times, usually, I mean, even after 12, the people who I thought were going to be the best on paper, not always, but almost all of them were the ones who I was like, okay, these are the people I thought I wanted to take into the final round in both cases. And I think it's the second time through, I really focus on just interviewing, you know, half, fewer than half, you know, 4 or 5 people tops. And that I felt like was a much better strategy.
Yeah. And you also have to be careful if you interview, you know, say 12 people, I did the same thing, that you don't fall victim to your own cognitive biases. So there's, for people who are interviewing for jobs, there's all of this data that suggests you should either go first or you should go last, because people are prone to primacy or recency bias. So you tend to remember either the first thing you're exposed to or the last thing you're exposed to. And the ones in the middle kind of run together and are less memorable. So it's almost like as you're scheduling these interviews, the people who bookend it, you have to be careful not to fall victim to your biases and think they're the best or the most memorable.
Yeah, it is tough. And it's also tough with thinking through, I mean, the role I was hiring for was primarily a writing role, but it's very difficult to interview somebody and interview candidate A, who's maybe not as good of a writer, but they're very charismatic, they're very warm, and interview candidate B, and they're much maybe more reserved and quiet. And this isn't a reflection on who I ended up hiring, because Laura's actually a pretty charismatic woman, but it's very hard to not let your biases and how you personally respond to somebody not impact how you're hiring them, and really be able to look at the skills you're hiring for in a vacuum. That's tough to do.
It is.
Salary discussions can be tricky. Warning, discuss at the right time. I'd love to hear how you did this, because I did it two ways and neither way I was really thrilled with. So how did you approach that?
So I've done this also two ways. My initial inclination was to wait to take them through two rounds of interviews and then ask about salary. And then I got all these people who I thought were great candidates, and they quoted me a number that was twice or three times what I could afford. And I was like, wow, I wasted so much of my own time and their time. So what I started doing is I started asking them on their initial phone screen. So I moved it right up front. And now every time I have an initial phone screen, I say, and I frame it as, what are you making now? And what, you know, what are your salary requirements for this job? And I say, look, you know, just ballpark. I don't need you to give me a number. This is not a negotiation. And then I found that most people throw out, well, at my current job, I'm making X.
And
if they're smart, they'll inflate it. But I don't think they do all the time, because I try to catch them off guard with it. Because I think people are not ready for you to ask it so soon in the process, so they haven't prepared their fake story.
Yeah, see, I didn't ask that question, because if I was interviewing, I would say, well, that's completely irrelevant. Because the value I'm receiving from my current employer, it shouldn't have any negotiation on this. Because, of course, if you give them a number, that's going to really limit your ability to negotiate. And then also, it really isn't relevant. I mean, it depends on how much value you can bring and how much you're willing to pay. And so, but people were pretty willing to tell you that, huh?
Everyone told me.
No. Okay. Wow.
Yep. Without even hesitating. Nobody even vacillated, and I had to push. Everybody was like, well, and that was usually their default. They were like, oh, they were kind of surprised that I asked. And I could tell they didn't have a prepared answer. And then so they just fell back on what they were making now. And while, yes, what they're making now should not be relevant to what they make with you, because it's a matter of value delivered for you, the new employer, it is totally relevant to them.
That's
because they've structured their entire expense of life based on what the salary level is. So if they're making 80 grand and you ask them to make 20 grand, even if they're only delivering 20 grand of value to their business, they will never take that job. Yeah. So you need to know that up front.
And I did almost exactly the same thing, Bill. In the first round, when I got into my final candidate, again, I made an offer and she was probably, 50, 60% above what I was planning on paying. And I think she really was interested in the position. But I think given where she, you know, where she lived and her lifestyle and things like that, it just would have been a really hard, I don't know if it would have financially been feasible. So I did the same thing too. I waited till the very end and then figured out, crap. I just spent all this time and we're completely on opposite ends. And so the second time I didn't ask it at all. And I didn't ask it at all, but I just posted the salary range up front in ad when I posted it a second time. And that, I think that helped a lot more with screening with people in terms of at least people know where roughly where you are. And so nobody is going to apply at that case. And if you're, you know, reasonably within those guidelines, you're going to be totally shocked if that's what you offer them.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it also is just put it right out there up front.
Yeah. One thing I learned too is make sure you're hunting in the right spots. Like the first time I went through is I needed someone who wrote really well and ideally had, you know, knew something about e-commerce, although I was more interested in a great, fantastic, hardworking writer than I was someone who was a, you know, e-commerce guru, because I think smart people can learn anything. It's much harder to teach someone how to write well than it is potentially e-commerce over the course of 6 months. And the first time I just blasted it out to my email list and I thought, hey, kind of just going to my existing audience will work best. And I did get some great candidates that way, but ultimately the second time what I ended up doing was really focusing on the core skills that I was looking for, which was writing. And so I went out to journalism job boards and professional writing boards. And I feel like the quality of applicants I got in that second round when I was focused on really the primary skill I was looking for was so much higher.
Yep. I had kind of an opposite experience. I thought, fish in the pools where there are the most fish. So I was hiring for a salesperson and I got advice also from my mentors, reach out to your network. I reached out to my whole network. I reached out to essentially everyone I knew and said, hey, I'm trying to hire a salesperson. I got almost no responses at all. And then I went, okay, this is going to be a professional person, a salesperson. I went to LinkedIn, posted the job on LinkedIn, cost me $129. And I got a whole bunch of crap, a whole bunch of people that didn't read the job description and just clicked apply. And I was like, well, this is no good. So then I went to Craigslist and I posted on Craigslist for $20 and I got 10x the qualified applicants from Craigslist who had read the job description, relevant experience, local. It was uncanny. I'd have no idea why, but a $20 Craigslist job ad turned out lots of totally legitimate people. I thought Craigslist was not going to be a quality pool at all, and I was totally wrong.
That's really cool. I use those jobs boards. I also use Craigslist, and you know, went through a bunch of cities, and I actually focused on cities where the cost of living was fairly low. So I focused on like Kansas City and Minneapolis and Pittsburgh and, you know, places like that, because all things equal, like it doesn't make sense to hire somebody in New York City when jobs location independent versus somebody in Omaha, Nebraska. It just doesn't, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And so that was another mistake I made and that helped out, I think, a lot with the second round was really focusing on lower cost areas. So
yeah. Yep, I can see that. My job was local dependent, so but I didn't have that issue, but that's smart.
Yeah. Finally, the tables turn when you make an offer. You know, the whole time people are pitching to you and selling you and trying to convince you that they're the ideal candidate, but as soon as you decide that you're going after somebody, you have to sell to them. And I think I took that a little too lightly at first. Obviously, it worked out, but I remember when I called Laura to make her the offer. And I kind of, you know, congratulated her, talked her through it. And we get off the phone. I got off the phone and I think two things happened. One, I think I was like, man, I should have prepared for that call a little bit more and like sold her on the company a little bit more. And secondly, I was a little worried. I was like, man, I really hope she takes it. I really should have thought through that call more. And so you really, the tables flip and don't take that for granted. Did you do a better job than I did of teeing that up for your candidate?
I did. So I actually approached this very, very deliberately because I knew it was so important for me to get the right person. I also knew that this person was going to be taking a chance on me and on Elements Brands because, you know, they were first employee. They're going to get a little bit of equity. They were going to be, you know, a large part of their salary was going to be commission based. I knew I wanted a good candidate and I knew that a good candidate would be taking a chance on me. So I even started selling it in the job ad. So I started at the very beginning and talked about career path, talked about responsibility, talked about visibility of the entire company, interaction with me, chance to hire a team underneath them in the long run, which is all totally true. But I put that in the job ad all the way up front because I wanted people to know when they applied that this was a long-term position. And then I worked it through all of my interview calls and my in-person interviews, you know, and I asked things like, you know, do you have experience managing people? And even if it wasn't immediately relevant, you know, I wanted to know that, but I also wanted to get them to tell me that so they were getting themselves excited about the career prospects. So a key in sales is to begin the sales process before you need to make the sale. So I started laying those seeds in the candidates long before I even knew I was going to make them an offer. So then by the time I did want to make them an offer, they had been repeatedly exposed to all the non-monetary upsides of the job, you know, 4 or 5 times over 2, 3, 4 weeks. So they really had an idea. So I've been selling them and developing a relationship over the long term, which I think really helped ultimately in getting a candidate in the end who has worked out fantastically and wanted to buy into the long-term future of the company.
Yeah, very smart. Subliminal advertising from day one is what you're doing.
It basically was. It really basically was. And the other thing I asked everybody in the initial phone screen that I didn't ask them before, but I started asking them right up front is, for me, it was very important to me that this person, I want this position that I hired to grow into vice president of sales at Elements mm-hmm. Brands. I want them to be around for a long time because employee churn is very expensive, especially for a small company, as we mentioned earlier. So I asked all of them in their first call, what's the 5-year plan for you? You know, I said, you know, so, you know, Ann or whatever your name is, what's the 5-year plan for Ann? You know, do you want to be in the city you're in? You know, and I got a lot of interesting comments on that. You know, I got some people that said, oh, well, you know, I think I might go back to school in a year or two. And, you know, that's not great for me because I was really, and I was set up front with them, you know, I want someone who's going to be here for 5 years. You know, I want someone who's going to be here for a while to build this company, to buy in for the long term. And so I asked them that right up front too. I think you're getting a sense, like I first wasted a lot of time and then I put in a couple of gates that said, I'm not going to take people through 3 rounds before I ask them the things I really want to ask them.
Yeah, I did the same thing too. And I was trying to also sell because it is, I mean, it's something I think that room for growth is attractive because the people that you want to come on are going to want to be able to grow and expand and mature and go to higher levels. And so I definitely queued that up. I think I did a little bit better job of that in the early stages versus that final pitch when I made the offer. But yeah, it's funny. You hear about kind of like the stock interview questions, right? Because like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? It's kind of one of those like stock interview questions, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times I almost didn't ask it because I figured like people are just going to say what you want to hear, as in I would love to be with this company in 5 years and slaving away and making you money and et cetera, et cetera. But it really surprised me how many people were like, huh, you know, I would really like to go study martial arts in Asia in 3 years after I make money. You know, it wasn't an answer, but giving you answers that you were like, I'm not sure if this person's thinking through this interview, like from my perspective, like,
even if that's true, you're not lying to me.
Yeah, true. Yes, very true. And I don't advocate lying in an interview and catering all your answers to be exactly what they want to hear. But the degree with which people were candid with me in a way which maybe didn't bode well for them in an interview process surprised me.
Yeah, it was appreciated. And so I was very deliberate. Because yeah, the where do you see yourself in 5 years is a very stock question. So my wording was very deliberate when I said, what is the 5-year plan for Anna? Mm. That kind of makes them think through like year one, year two, year three, you know, and they kind of think about the track. Whereas where do you see yourself in 5 years is very abstract, kind of far reaching thing. Mm-hmm. And I got much more deliberate answers from people than I said, what is the 5-year plan for your name? People have much more concrete ideas about that. And I think I got some really honest answers because of that.
You can find Bill's new course, Subliminal Hiring Techniques, at rebelceo.com. Bill.
I will be writing a post on that. I should. This has prompted me to do it.
Great. Well, Bill, thanks so much for coming on, man. And you are speaking at ECF Live Austin, which is going to be...
Yes, very excited.
Very happy you agreed to do that. So that's going to be a lot of fun. If you enjoyed Bill's you know, this conversation, make sure to come down and meet us there for that if you're a forum member, if we're able to hopefully have some spots, if we do have a couple extra spots for non-forum members. Bill, thanks so much, man. A pleasure as always. And if you're listening, want to catch up with Bill, he's over at rebelceo.com. And it sounds like there'll be a hiring post up there fairly shortly.
There will. Thanks, Andrew.
Awesome. Thanks, Bill. That's going to do it for this week. But if you're interested in launching your own e-commerce store, download my free 55-page ebook on niche selection and getting started. And if you're a bit more experienced, look into the e-commerce fuel private forum. It's a vetted community for store owners with at least 4,000 in monthly sales or industry professionals with at least a year or more experience in the e-commerce space. You can learn more about both the ebook and the forum at ecommercefuel.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday. We'll be right back.